It is an honor for me to have this conversation with David Grossman. This is an opportunity to make links between two worlds that are very close to my heart, psychoanalysis and literature, and this evening particularly Israeli modern literature, in which David Grossman is a unique and important writer. For me, reading his books always reconnects me to my roots and homeland. So I will start now. I thought to start by asking you about your special interest in children and in their internal world. In your writing, you have managed to get into children's minds and see the world from their eyes. A very striking example is Momik in the book See Under Love, particularly in the first chapter of the book. Thinking about children is, of course, in the heart of psychoanalysis. We explore the emotional world of children, we explore the fantasy world, and also when we see adult patients, we think about the child within the adult. I wonder if you would like to tell us more about your interest in children.
Shalom, and I'm glad to be here. And to talk about writing and about whatever Orna will ask me to talk about. I wrote quite a lot about children. I think every writer, in order almost to become a writer, has to go through this self-investigation and self-research that starts in childhood. Childhood fascinates me because of the energies, because of this movement towards the world, this situation in which you discover all your being is a being of decoding the reality around you. Everything is a mystery. I always think that it is also such an effort being a child. All the time have to understand. You all the time have to be prepared for the surprises and the dangers and the challenges that life brings upon you. Everything must be decoded, you know, the codes of the family, all the sensitivities of the relationship within the family, your role in this family, being a child versus the adults, the codes of society, the codes of manners, what is done, what is undone, how far do you stand from other people, are you allowed to touch them, are you not allowed to touch, the codes of the language, of course, all the mysteries that occur in your life. Why is that after the summer vacation I came back to the kindergarten and my best friend suddenly is one head taller than myself? How can it be? Where have I been when? What is this situation now that grandfather suddenly is not at home anymore, only grandma is there, and people are crying and they tell me all kind of stories, and I sense, not conscientiously but through the skin, I sense that something is wrong, that something is a secret that I'm not part of. I like to write about children because I like to bring myself to this position. I feel that so many of us at my age and even younger, we are already congealed children. We do not maintain the flexibility, the harmony with life that children sometimes have, not always, of course. I don't want to idealize childhood because, as I have said, it's a very demanding and anguishing phase of life as I see it. But I like to go back there because when you look at the world in the eyes of a child, nothing is taken for granted. This is maybe the essence of being a child. This is also the essence of being an artist. Nothing can be taken for granted. I always remember this story that I have that when years ago, when my eldest son, Jonathan, when he was 3 years old, I put him to bed and I told him, you know, it's the longest night of the year tonight. It was the 21st of December. And I covered him and I kissed him goodnight and went to do my things. And at first light, at dawn, he bursted into our room and he was all excited. And he said, Mama, Papa, it's over. The night is over. And can you imagine what he must have gone through in this night? Because for him, it was not taken for granted that the sun will rise again. You know, it's not taken for granted also for us. We have this illusion that since the sun has risen for so many millions of times, it will rise again tomorrow. But who knows? And when you are a child, your life are under the mark of this uncertainty, that you never know where your next step will be. Look at the way a child of 3 or 4, how they are moving. They don't really know. I mean, every step is a surprise, and they can be betrayed every moment by reality, by the rules that they have broken without knowing that they are breaking laws and rules, by their own bodies finding themselves suddenly on the floor in a tantrum attack, which a second before they didn't know that this is what is going to happen to them. And of course, all this to see a human being that is in such a transparent phase of his life, to see how he or she adjusts to their own self, how they get to know who they are. This question that very slowly, intuitively is unfolded, not formulated, of course, at that age, but it is there. Who am I? Who am I? What kind of person am I going to be when gradually I'll grow up and discover that? And of course, the attempt to document this complicated existence. There is some water here if you want. Yeah. To document this existence in the language of a child. I once wrote a play it's not available in English. In English, it's called the Ricky Kindergarten's group, something like that. Gan Ricky. It's about 9 children in a kindergarten, 2 mornings, and how they create all their relationship with all the nuances, with all the layers, with all the hierarchies in a kindergarten, with all this self-discovery of who they really are, what is their place in the hierarchy of children. And all that I had to convey with the language of 3 years old, no more than that. And it was such a wonderful challenge, you know, to try to reduce all the verbality of the grown-up writer to the 3 years old protagonist. And whenever they said something that was not from the range of 3 years old, immediately you could understand that they are quoting someone, yes? And you see how the dictation of the home, of the parents, is dominant and how it is dictating their world view from now onward.
I think.
Oh, okay.
I think that we should say a few words also about adolescence, because there are so much in the center of many of your books. Just to take one example, in the book of Intimate Grammar, there is a boy called Aaron who is on the threshold between childhood and adolescence. And this boy finds this prospect of growing up and rediscovering his sexuality alarming. And what happens to him is that he literally stops growing. This is really the book that I like most of your work, because I think that for me it is one of the most beautiful literary explorations of the anxieties and of the pain of growing up. I wonder if you would like to say a few words about your interest in adolescence and in the emotional experience of being an adolescent.
Well, first, maybe I should state it out immediately. I mean, if I had 300 years of life, probably I would write 100 years about childhood, 100 years about adolescence. But since life is outrageously short, I have to, you know, restrain myself a little and to... Yeah, I wrote a lot about adolescence as well. Again, it's another phase in our life where it is so clear that we are traveling through our destiny. You know, you enter this tunnel of adolescence when you are 12, 13. You emerge from this tunnel when you are 18. Well, today it's 28, 29, yes, but in my generation, it was shorter somehow, and you will come out of this tunnel totally different in body, in soul. So many things will be changed inside you. You will reveal so many new things about yourself, about the world, and in a way, it is done to you, and you have no choice. You are totally passive. You do not choose the body in which you will dwell all your life. And in a way, you are aware of that. You are aware, you don't want to be too much aware because it is uncontainable. This knowledge of what is happening to us in these 3, 4, 5 years of adolescence might be unbearable even, especially for sensitive children, especially for someone like Aaron from the Book of Intimate Grammar, which he feels so threatened by the very fact that he is subject to a process that everyone undergoes. And he does not want to be part of something that everyone undergoes. And he does not want to be imprisoned in those definitions that are imposed on him by the bureaucracy of the glands. It is not something that he had chosen. He wants to initiate what happens to him. And of course, I mean, he wants to be like everyone else, because this is another sign, symptom of this period. Adolescents really want to be like others. And at the same time, it threatens him. And he feels that it deprives him of the privilege to express his own idiosyncratic voice. And he struggles desperately to find some ways to express his idiosyncrasy, his uniqueness. And for him, it is the language. Because in a way, this book, the Intimate Grammar book, is about the childhood of the artist. The artist as a young man, yeah. And for him, he understands, again, instinctively, intuitively, that the language that he will choose will be his way to say I, to not belong to this general process that everybody undergoes. And he has this strange mechanism. He wants that the words that he uses will be his only. So he knows that his brain, the brain that is dominated by the major gland that fails to make him mature, fails to allow him to reach puberty, he knows that this brain is an enemy. So he has to create for himself another brain in his body. And under his heart, he creates an alternative brain for himself. And since he understands the importance of the words that he will utter, that he will use, he creates a hospital for sick words. Words that he takes, absorbs from the outside, from the radio and from conversations that he eavesdrops on the bus, on the street, things that he hears that his parents are talking. And of course, so many of the people around him are talking in clichés. It's all the language that he hears is a patchwork of clichés. And he cannot take it. It disgusts him. He does not want to become part of this constitution of the clichés. He wants to have his own words, own syntax. And so he takes these words, the sick words, the words that were overused and abused by others, and he purifies them in a very complicated bureaucratic process. Because, as you know, in order to fight bureaucracy, we become bureaucratic. This is... You can never really win over bureaucracy. And only then he manages to liberate himself by finding his own language. Well, I think this is enough for adolescents. I mean, you still have some... You see why I write long books and not haiku poems of... Yeah.
In psychoanalysis, we try to get into our patient's shoes, so to speak, in order to see things from the patient point of view. But the analyst also has to take some distance in order to be able and to observe the patient and to observe the interaction in the consulting room in order to be able to think about the patient. I wondered if the writer, if you as a writer, has to do something similar, to have this dual perspective towards your characters and towards your story.
Well, literature is not psychoanalysis, and not psychology, and not sociology, and not history, and not so many other things. It's, in a way, a combination of elements from all the above, but it is something different. I think in your profession, as a psychoanalyst, your mission, your goal is, you know, if I can compare you to the, I don't know how you say it in English, the guy who works in swimming pools and rescue people who are drowning? Lifesaver.
Lifeguard.
Lifeguard, yeah. So, I mean, you sit there out of the pool, you see someone drowning and you jump and you rescue him. You want to bring him back to the shore. I want to drown with him. That's... I want to document the process of the drowning. I would love him to be able, this character that I write about, I would love him to be able to go back to the shore and to recover. And many of my protagonists are people who are undergoing this process of being saved by themselves, mainly by others, yes. But first, I need to understand, what does it mean to drown? How do you feel when you are losing everything? when life is draining out of you, when all your mechanisms collapse, of course there is a stage in writing. There is a moment where even if I write about this person who drowned, I want also to write about the person who saved him. And to be fully with this character. And part of the pleasures of writing is the ability that it gives you to prevail in different and sometimes contradictory characters, characters that are even hostile to each other. Sometimes they defy each other. And you have the privilege of being both of them, or many boths, you know, two, three, five, six different characters. Everyone totally different from the other. And you know, I think a writer feels that he got to the right point where when he is able to allow this other to prevail inside him, inside the writer, and to be himself, to be this character, to accept that the other has the right to be an other. I am writing this character. I am totally invested emotionally in this character. But I will allow this character to be totally different from myself. And I will follow what it will suggest me. And I will not push it beyond its borders. And I remember in one of my books that is called Be My Knife, I wrote about a character, Yair, who falls in love with Miriam. He is married, she is married, and yet he sees her and she arouses in him a very strong need, urge to tell her his story. Maybe this is the heart of life, that you find a person that you really want to tell him or her your story and that you feel confident enough that they will accept you. Sometimes not because of what you are, but in spite of what you are. They will contain. And this Yair, he's a person full of inner contradictions. He has 12 elbows, you know. He kicks in all directions. It was writing, he was like riding a horse or a bull in a rodeo. I never knew who is riding whom, yeah, who is on top. But these are the characters that I love to write about, because they are so unexpected. And they have this promise, they contain this promise to take me beyond my limitations as a human being, as a certain human being. And they can take me beyond it and surprise me and frighten me and shock me and bring me to the worst corners in myself, to the places where I'm really ashamed of. And they allow me to write them, to explore these places. And I try to remember how I got to Yair. These two people, Yair and Miriam, they start to create for themselves their hermetic verbal bubble. They start to talk with each other in a language that becomes more and more private, more and more intimate, to the extent, I think, that the reader or readers can feel even embarrassed of peeping into something that is so intimate, that they are invading the privacy of these two other individuals. And I'm afraid I lost the thread of the thought. I try
I don't remember how I made this detour into this book. Never mind, I'll get it.
Okay. When I reread a few of David's books for this evening, I noticed that quite a few of his books are written as stories that one character is telling the other. And I thought it's a fascinating dynamic process in which internal changes take place in both characters as well as in the relationships between them. And I thought that really reminded me again of the consulting room in which we try to listen to the narrative of our patients and that we see that this narrative changes and develops and it is colored by the dialogue that is going on and develops between analyst and patient. It also has an impact on the analyst and the way he sees himself. I wonder if you would like to comment about that.
Yes, when we talked about it before in the green room, which is always gray, you mentioned this question, and I thought that you were right. In many of my books, this motif of the storytelling as a way to change things and to revitalize and to redeem people from a certain predicament, this motif, this idea is very present. It is probably because of how important it is for me. The power of the story, the way in which I feel that stories can reorganize reality. If you tell something that is already known to people, but if you tell it a little differently, if you stress other nuances, if you use a new vocabulary, if you allow the people to be opened to words and to formulations that until now they were blocked in front of, they were unwilling to inhale, suddenly things change in reality. You can see it in life of individuals and you as psychoanalysts and those of you here who work as people who treat other people, who constantly sit hours and hours and listen to the stories of other people. You know, the power of a story and the danger of a story, the way in which people are getting entrenched or fossilized even in the story that they tell themselves, how they do not find any way to get out of it, how they start to formulate all their life experience in the terminology that is the most traumatic for them. It applies both to individuals, but also to nations, to societies. It is so easy to see how we can be trapped in the national narrative, in the story we tell ourselves, how by so doing we doom ourselves time and again to repeat our historic mistakes, how we recognize ourselves only if we doom ourselves to go again and again to the same traumatic stations. But rarely we have the power to transform these stations into something more positive, more redeeming and liberating, but rather you see how people go back to their trauma, people and peoples go back to their trauma and being trapped there. And by the very act of being trapped, they approve something to themselves that probably is very deep and strong essential for their identity, but at the same time it is imprisoning them in this predicament. For me the most fresh example from my writing is from my last book that maybe we shall talk about a little later. It is not yet translated to English. But even in Sea Under Love, there is the Jewish storyteller Wasserman, who is brought to extermination camp, and the Nazis try to kill him, and he's unkillable. He's immortal. He's the immortal, eternal Jew. He cannot be killed, by no way. But he wants to be killed. He's fed up with life. And so he strikes a very strange deal with the commander of this extermination camp, that every night he will tell the commander a story, because he is a storyteller. And if the story is good enough, the commander will try to kill him. It's kind of a other way around Shahrazad, yeah? He wants to earn his death. And of course, what happens over nights and nights is that the commander of the camp no longer can relate to Wasserman as the Jew, as a faceless Jew, as a stereotype, but he really is being he becomes more aware of his qualities as a human being. And this is the hidden agenda of Wasserman. He tells the reader. He all the time talks to us behind the shoulder of Nigel, the commander. He tells, I want to infect Nigel with humanity. And so he does. And so he does. And he does it through a story. Because there is something in stories, and really, it's hard to explain. There is something of almost an alchemy in that. In the way stories act on us, in the way they touch something so primal about us. You know, sometimes, especially in Israel, I sit in front of people and I read from my books. And usually these meetings take place at 8:30 at night, and the people are tired and they're not very young, and you can see all the harshness of life in general and life in Israel, particularly how they anguish them. And I read, and after some minutes of reading, I raise up my eyes and I look at the people, and you see how suddenly they are bereft from all this harshness of life, and how something almost childish emerges when they allow themselves to listen to a story. And I remember this experience from reading stories to my children before they went to bed, and as I said, from the experience to others. There is something in stories that allow us, again, in a way that I cannot explain, maybe someone here can explain, allow us to go to the very primal place of ourselves and to see things a little different, and to allow the story to evocate things within us that otherwise cannot be evocated.
I think that's a good point to ask you to read to us. what actually David chose is to read a passage from Sea Under Love.
I'll read two short passages, one in Hebrew to allow the Hebrew to echo here, and then I'll read it in English. It's about Momik. Momik is 9 years old, Jerusalemite child. He's the son of two survivors from the Shoah. Shoah is the Holocaust. I prefer the Hebrew term. And he hears from everyone around him, he hears the phrase, the Nazi beast, the Nazi beasts. Hachayah Nazit in Hebrew. This is how Nazism was referred to when I was a child, and even today you will hear it quite often in Israel. And he becomes obsessed. What is this beast? How can you find it? And then he hears about Simon Wiesenthal, the Nazi's hunter. So he sits and he writes letters to the hunter because the hunter knows about the beast. And again, no one wants to tell him about the Nazis. And this was the experience of myself as a child in Israel in the end of the 50s, the beginning of the 60s. They didn't want to tell us. It was everywhere. But they didn't want to tell us. And I must tell you that when my children started to ask me about the Nazis, I also felt this reluctance to expose them to the atrocities, to these landscapes of mankind's abilities. I remember when my eldest son, when he came back the first time from the kindergarten, asked me what were the Nazis, why did they do it to us, why to us especially. Maybe it's not good to be a Jew because see what they are doing to us. And he started to investigate and to ask for details, as children often do. And I felt that I did not want to tell him that. I felt that once this pure and naive child will be exposed to this, when these atrocities will be formulated in his mind, he will never be the same child again. And in a way, he will never remain a child after knowing that. And I mean, it's me who had written a whole book about a child growing up in silence. And suddenly I realized how, especially being a Jew, being an Israeli, in an age that parents are embarrassed to talk to their children about facts of life, we have first to confront facts of death. And Momik, he goes to Bella, the owner of the grocery store, also survivor from the Shoah, from over there. You know, it's interesting. I think that in Hebrew or in English or in any other language the Jews are talking about the Shoah, they will speak about over there. When non-Jews are talking about these events, they will usually talk about what had happened then. There is a huge difference between there and then. Momik. Yom achrei yom, באולם הקריאה של המבוגרים בספריית בית העם, ישב מומיק על כיסא גבוה, והרגליים שלו התנדנדו באוויר. הוא סיפר להילל הספרן שהוא מכין עבודה מיוחדת על השואה לכיתה, ויותר לא שאלו אותו. הוא קרא ספרי היסטוריה בלי ניקוד על הדברים שהנאצים עשו, ושבר את השיניים בכל מיני מילים וביטויים שהיו רק בתקופה ההיא. היה מסתכל המון זמן בצילומים משונים שבשום פנים ואופן לא הצליח להבין מה יש בהם, ומה קורה שם, ומה שייך למי. אבל בלב הוא כבר התחיל להרגיש שהצילומים האלה כנראה מגלים לו את ההתחלה של הסוד שכולם שמרו ממנו. הוא ראה תמונות של הורים שצריכים לבחור בין שני ילדים שלהם, מי יישאר איתם ומי ילך לתמיד, וניסה לחשוב איך הם יבחרו, לפי מה. וראה איך חייל מכריח איש זקן לרכוב על איש זקן אחר כמו על סוס, וראה צילומים של הוצאות להורג בהמון צורות שאף פעם לא ידע שיש כאלה, וראה תמונות של קברים שקבורים בהם יחד המון מתים, שוכבים בצורות משונות, אחד על השני ואחד עם הרגל על הפנים של השני, ואחד עם הראש מסובב עקום כל כך שאפילו שניסה לא הצליח לסובב ככה. לאט לאט הוא התחיל להבין דברים חדשים, כמו למשל כמה הגוף של הבן אדם זה דבר חלש. שיכול להישבר לכל מיני צורות ולכל הכיוונים אם רק רוצים לשבור אותו. וכמה משפחה זה דבר חלש. אם רק רוצים לפרק אותה, צ'יק צ'ק זה יכול לקרות והכל נגמר לתמיד. מומיקה היה יוצא מהספרייה בשש בערב, עייף ושקט מאוד. כשהיה נוסע הביתה באוטובוס, הוא לא ראה כלום ולא שמע כלום. Bella, the owner of the grocery store, told him, after a heavy pressure on his side, that the Nazi beast can come out of any creature if it only gets the right food and nourishment. Of course, she says it ironically, but he is only almost 9 years old and he is very serious. He takes her very seriously. And so he decides that he shall raise up, he will collect some animals and raise them in the cellar underneath the apartment of his parents, the survivors from the Shoah. He will raise the beasts, hoping that from one of them, the Nazi beast would come out suddenly. And of course, in order to make the beast come out, he has to learn more and more about it. So he goes to the library and starts to read. And he becomes a kind of a scholar regarding the Shoah at his very young age. Day after day, in the adult reading room at the public library, Momik sat on a high-backed chair with his feet dangling down. He told Hillel, the librarian, that he was working on a special report for school about the Holocaust, and no one asked any questions. He read history books with tiny print about what the Nazis did and stumbled over a lot of words and expressions that weren't used anymore. He puzzled over some peculiar photographs. He couldn't figure out what was going on and what went where, but deep down inside, he began to sense that these photographs might reveal the first part of the secret everyone had tried to keep from him. There were pictures of a mother and a father forced to choose between two children, to choose which one would stay with them and which one would go away forever. And he tried to figure out how they would choose, according to what. And he saw a picture of a soldier forcing an old man to ride another old man like a horse. And he saw pictures of executions in ways he never knew existed. And he saw pictures of graves where a lot of dead people lay in the strangest positions on top of each other with somebody's foot stuck in somebody else's face and somebody's head on so crooked, Mommy couldn't twist his head around like that. And so little by little, Mommy started to understand new things, like how weak the human body is, for instance, and how it can break in so many shapes and directions if you want to break it, and how weak a thing, a family is if you want to break it. Just like that it happens, and it's all over. At 6 in the evening, Momik would leave the library, tired and quiet. On the bus home, he didn't see or hear anything.
Of course, we can't do justice to this great book, See Under Love, but I wanted just to take one point from the book and relate to it. And this is what Bella, this woman, tells Momik when she says to him that the Nazi beast could come from any kind of animal. I saw that this is really a profound statement that is very relevant to us as psychoanalysts and psychotherapists, because it suggests that hate and cruelty and destructiveness are not only horrible qualities that belong to other kind of people or to our enemies, if you like, that these are feelings that we all have to battle with and to tame. And that in psychoanalysis, we think that it is the love to our objects. And by this, I mean to It is the love to people that are meaningful to us and are alive in our mind that helps us to battle with the hate. What I wanted to ask you is, how do you bring together this understanding of human nature with the experience of the Holocaust and also with the experience of growing up under the shadow of the Holocaust, which I think was the experience of our generation in Israel?
Before you start, David, I'm just aware of time, and I know that you have another question that you wanted to ask, which we want to get to, so...
What do you suggest?
I suggest that perhaps since we've talked quite a lot about Siander Love and about the Holocaust, I wonder whether perhaps, you know, given that you made the very interesting link, I think, to hate inside ourselves and, you know, the issue of projection, I think perhaps we can move on. I don't know how you guys feel.
There is...
You know,
I suggest that I will answer it. You know, in a way, all the answers are the same answer. I mean, it's in a way, yeah, because everything is connected to each other, and I guess that probably I will answer by that the next question, which I don't know what it is, but I guess I will. When I wrote this book, Siander Love, I was obsessed by two questions. One is, if I was there as a Jew in a ghetto, in a concentration extermination camp, what could I have put, or what could I have had in order to maintain myself as a human being in a reality that was created in order to obliterate the uniqueness of human being, in a reality that brought certain people, the Jews mostly, but there were also others, to the lowest level possible of flesh and blood that were meant to be exterminated in utmost efficiency. In a reality that people were bereft of their privacy, of their intimacy, of their families, of their love, of their talents, of their secrets, in a reality where people had no names but only numbers tattooed on the arm. How can one maintain his or her uniqueness as a human being? This was the first question. You know, it makes me think of this Jewish legend of the Luz. I don't know if you heard about. You know that there is a Jewish belief that every one of us, on the top of the backbone, the spine, we have this little bone. You have it, trust me. Every one of you. And according to the Jewish belief, in this little bone, all the essence of you as a human being is maintained. And this bone cannot be crushed, cannot be burnt. Nothing can eradicate it. And in day of resurrection, the human being will be resurrected, recreated from this little bone. So this, it contains the essence of yourself as an individual, each and every one of you. And there were years where I had this mental exercise. I asked people that were meaningful for me, what do they think is their lose? And I got very interesting questions. Of course, parents told about their parenthood, and artists told about their urge of creativity, of creating things. There was a woman who was then 90 years old, and she said that her Luz is her beloved husband that died something like 46 years ago. There was a woman who told me that her Luz is longings, which I thought it's... So I asked myself, what is the Luz that could have maintained and kept me there? But I also asked, had I been a German in these times, what could I have put in front of this enormous wave that swept almost everyone there in Germany or in other countries and allowed them to collaborate with this machinery of evil in such an efficient way, in a way that will almost not contradict some primal moral instinct that most of us have. The problem that we have when we come to face the question of the Nazis is the fact that most of them were normal people. It would have been much easier had they been all psycho and crazy people and distorted, but they were not. They were normal, usual people that step by step were brought it upon themselves to collaborate with this machinery of evil in a way that did not contradict their instincts. You know, Hannah Arendt talked about the banality of evil, and sometimes we mistake it and we think that evil is banal, but evil is sometimes just the opposite of banal. Even evil is very creative in the forms that it hides itself, in its mechanisms. But evil is a genius in using our propensity towards the banality, our eagerness to collaborate with the routine, with the cliché, with the automaton behavior. And those two questions, I think, are questions that everyone should ask. You don't have to be a Jew for that, of course. You can be born much, much after the Second World War and the Shoah, but these are questions that we must ask ourselves constantly. These two questions. Because maybe these are the two questions that if we ask them seriously, and if we find for ourselves, each one for him or herself, if we find the right answer, maybe we shall be more immune from the collaboration with this machinery. Maybe we shall be much more aware and sharp to trace all kind of small hints in our society, in our nation, where we start to collaborate with this blindness towards evil, with this machinery, the routine of evil, of subjugating others in all contexts. And everyone and every society and every nation has its own points of blindness and evils that it collaborates with. And we all get used to it. We are very talented in allowing it to happen.